of green, red roses too.
This is Ed Cohen, your host of Global Radio Talk Show, a broadcast service of globalbusinessnews.net. Coming to you from Melbourne, Australia and San Diego, California. So our special guest today is Siobhan McHale. She's with the Deluxe Group Limited from Melbourne, Australia. She is head of HR, Executive General Manager of Human Resources for the Deluxe Group. That's D-U-L-U-X, Deluxe Group Limited, an international paints and coatings company. Her key focus is helping to create a more innovative, consumer-driven, and growth-oriented culture at work. Siobhan McHale is a culture change specialist, also an organizational psychology, if you couldn't guess. She's an HR executive leading the shift to a more growth-oriented and consumer-driven culture, and that will fuel the company's next wave of expansion. So let's say hello to Siobhan.
Hi, Ed. Great to be with you today.
Thank you. So you're originally from Ireland, is that correct?
Correct, yes. Originally from Ireland, and I moved to Australia in 1994.
Now, why did you go?
I'd already moved to England, actually. So I'd been living, studying for my master's in psychology in England and living in London for a number of years. But then my parents moved from Ireland to Australia, and I actually had three brothers and a sister who are also living in Australia. So made the decision to move down under.
So the weather's a lot better, I guess.
Yeah, Melbourne's not quite as good as Sydney, but it is a beautiful, it's a beautiful country.
I have not been, but Joanne and I are planning to go down under in 2019 sometime, probably summer or fall, our summer.
Yeah.
You are a longtime change advisor, I'm reading your bio, and you wanted some skin in the game, it says. So you joined the workforce. So you're happy you did that, I guess, right?
Yeah, I was actually standing in a taxi rank in Chicago airport in my early 30s one night. I'd flown in to go to St. Charles. I was working at Accenture at the time, so going to a training course in St. Charles, their global education center. And I sort of had an aha moment when I thought I spent a decade flying across Europe and working in Asia, working in Australia, working in parts of America. And I really was just flying in and out telling managers how to change workplace culture. And I really wanted to be part of an organization and actually doing the work to change the culture side by side with leaders. So at that stage in my early 30s, I made the decision to become an insider and to join a series of organizations helping to transform workplace culture from the inside.
Getting people to change their ways in an organization that's successful is probably one of the more difficult chores, I would imagine. Would you agree?
Absolutely correct. I think when things are going badly, then there's a burning platform, as they say, and it's easier to convince people that change is needed. But when a company is very successful, then there can be a complacency where people think, well, what we've done has always worked for us, and that can be dangerous in disruptive times.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to zero in on a couple of things, and I have some very specific questions to ask. What is diversity and inclusion from your point of view?
I suppose diversity and inclusion, from my perspective, means, you know, an analogy I sometimes use is you get invited to the dance, but you also get asked to dance when you're at the dance. So, you know, that's the distinction between diversity and inclusion. You get invited and then you're asked to dance. So I think diversity is a whole range of things. It can be diversity from a gender perspective, from a background perspective, but also from a thinking perspective. You know, you want enough diversity of thought in the organization to get you to that high performance status. So I often think of the Nokia example, where the executives, many of the senior executives, all came from Finland, and they were treated as rock stars in their own company. And Nokia actually had the technology to compete with Apple, but it was completely blindsided because there was almost an insularity in that company. So it went from the one of the most powerful brands in the world, and we probably all know the story, to being taken over by Microsoft because of that lack of diversity of thinking.
Okay, let's zero in now. From that point of view, what is culture? How would you define culture?
It's an interesting question. I was catching up with a friend of mine. Let's call him Jonathan. He's a partner at a consulting firm, and he'd stayed in consulting while I'd moved into organizations. But he was having difficulty changing his culture in the consulting firm. And I asked him that question. I said, what do you think culture is? And he said, well, it's the values and behaviors at work, Siobhan. And I said, well, that is one of the elements of culture, but it isn't at the heart of culture. So what's at the heart of culture, which is the ways of doing things, but at the heart of culture is the deeply embedded patterns in an organization, and these the unwritten, co-created rules of engagement that actually are often invisible to leaders.
So much of the time, up to now, I think you'd agree, it's all guys, right? Mostly guys?
Yeah. In what respect?
Well, it's men, right? And, you know, it's not all guys are athletes, or were, but there's like a team, and there's like a competition, and there's like a struggle, and it's a game. Mm. Game theory.
Mm.
And so that's culture too, isn't it?
Totally, yeah.
So culture matters a lot, of course. So asking somebody to change, it's not like bringing a quote-unquote girly attitude or a female approach into a male bastion. But I'm sure you had some of those experiences. And I was just wondering if it's any different in Australia than California, for instance.
Well, I think all of those dynamics are exactly what I'm talking about, these deeply embedded ways of doing things that in some cultures it's a male-dominated, or it might be a game, or it might be a... It's unique to each organization what that particular pattern is. So if I go back to the story of Jonathan, my friend, one of the deeply embedded patterns in the consulting firm was this tried and tested ways of doing things. So they kept on going back to the old way that they used to do things. And that was part of that was the boys club, as you say, but part of it was just the traditional thinking. And the clients were saying, we don't want those old ways. We want innovation. We want agile. We want you to bring us more out-of-the-box solutions. And Jonathan was struggling with that because his firm was losing 4 proposals in a row. It had lost because it wasn't bringing the clients what they wanted to see. It was trotting out the same tired old thinking. But when I said to Jonathan, well, what did you do when you lost the last proposal? Did you sign off on that proposal? He said, oh, actually, yeah, I did sign off on it because we were pushed for time, Siobhan. So I just signed off on the same tired old thinking. And therein lies the pattern, because Jonathan was actually signaling to his team that it was okay to give the clients the same tired old thinking that they'd always given them. So this is the patterned nature of culture, where leaders inadvertently fuel the patterns that they are seeking to change. So on the one hand, Jonathan was saying to his people, I want more innovative thinking. But on the other hand, he was signing off on a proposal where they were trotting out the same tired thinking and the same tired approaches. So leaders co-create the culture within their organization.
I'm going to come back to the culture idea, but of course everything that we're talking about has to do with cultural ways of doing things, ways of thinking of things. But for your company, your current company, Dulux, am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, Dulux. Yeah, Dulux Group. Correct.
All right. So this is like a It's not a chemical company, it's a paint company, right?
Yeah, paints and consumer goods. So we do a range of consumer goods, but primarily paints and coatings.
Now, what is the next wave of expansion in that kind of a business? Can you share that? What's the next wave of expansion?
Yeah, so we've got some brands that are very well loved within Australia and New Zealand. And one of the challenges for the leadership group here is how do you take those well-loved Australian brands and bring them into other markets, you know, overseas, international markets?
So the next wave of expansion is taking the brand into other countries. Is that correct?
Yes. That's correct. Yeah, so we've been focused on how we can open up overseas markets in the last few years and how we can take our very well-loved Australian brands into different territories. So, for example, we've bought a paint factory in Glasgow in Scotland, and we're opening up some stores in the UK. And we've also got some headway in Indonesia, where we've got a joint venture there, and we're also in parts of Asia. So we are definitely on track to expand our international footprint.
So part of that is what, some kind of a media or a lifestyle campaign, visuals, YouTube, I would guess, showing people in a lifestyle situation but surrounded by red or blue or pastel color walls, I guess, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we have different media campaigns. Part of it is strategy as well, just determining where in the world we want to be and where we've got opportunities for success. But part of that is also culture as well. It's shifting your mindset into what is your role. So one of our businesses, for example, the Yates business, which is a garden care business, they were purely focused on Australia and New Zealand, but then they shifted their perception of their role to global. So they said, well, rather than just Yates Australia and New Zealand, imagine if we were Yates Global. So some of the executives went on a global tour and started to see the developments that were happening internationally, in particular with the organics and garden care, because that's one of our product sets. And they began to explore the opportunities for buying an organics company, which they've just done. So that will enable them to expand their product set overseas into the organics business. So part of it is that the change has to happen in people's minds before it happens in reality.
Sounds like you need to be in Silicon Valley and San Diego.
Why is that?
Well, because this, you know, California, coastal California is very much into that, organics and healthy.
Yeah.
And new ideas and new looks.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was one of the things we discovered, that actually a lot of our products would go well, very well in California. So,
well,
yeah, we do
awesome.
Paints, we do sealants, yeah. We do gardening, we do garage doors, a whole lot of consumer goods that we think are terrific, but we're interested in expanding overseas now.
Yeah. I want to guide you that it's coastal California rather than inland California, which is a very different world. And so coastal California, there's plenty of people living in coastal California, but
yes.
It's a very different culture. So let's talk about culture and changing. How do you change a workplace culture?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's probably one of the most difficult challenges that leaders face in my experience as a culture specialist over many years. And in my opinion, it's one of the reasons that change, you know, you hear these statistics about the failure rate of change, which some people say is up to 75% of all change efforts fail to deliver the expected values. And I have a hypothesis that one of the reasons that they fail is that the leaders put in technical solutions, so they put in new processes and new systems, but they fail to change the underlying culture. So despite the fact that there are new processes and systems, people work around those, and they find ways to avoid adhering to the new processes and systems, and they go back to the old ways of doing things, which is the culture. So in order to change the culture, you've got to firstly, see the culture, see the patterns in the culture. So in my example earlier with my friend Jonathan from the consulting firm, he was addressing the behaviors of the consultants, but he wasn't really changing the underlying patterns in the culture. So he was sending the consultants on to innovation training to make them more innovative. He was introducing a new values booklet to try and get them to be more innovative. He even redesigned his whole office to make it look more funky and creative. But none of these things were helping to shift the pattern in the culture, because he had to change. So he had to start becoming a leader of innovation in order to and demand more innovation from his consultants, not the same tired old thinking in the proposals. So that's key. He had to see the pattern. He had to see how he was co-creating the culture, and he had to break that pattern. And that's difficult for leaders to do, right? Because they have to see something that they've created themselves, which is always hard. And B, they've got to break out of the old habits and create the wave of change, not blame other people for it. So Jonathan had to stop pointing the finger at his consultants and actually look at himself and say, how do I need to change? What role do I need to step into in order to change to a more innovative culture at the consulting firm?
So does he, so as part of that, there could be several different pathways, I would assume. Like, for instance, one day showing up on a motor scooter as opposed to a Land Rover, or having some young staffer who's into technology and doing a podcast series with the boss and having it show up on everybody's messenger. On the phone at 7:30 in the morning and saying,
this is
your new world. Get ready. Starting down.
Correct. Such a great, I think what you're raising is the power of symbols. So when you're in the midst of culture change and you're trying to trigger this change, often symbols play a huge role. And I'm reminded by the story of a CEO I once worked with at a bank. And in his first week in the bank, he knew he had to shake things up, and he knew it was very bureaucratic. And when he got in to work on his first day, he got a call and he parked. He was actually driving his daughter's car because he hadn't had time to buy a car. He was moving countries for this job, and his daughter had a red Jeep. So he borrowed her red Jeep and he drove the red Jeep into the car park, and he went up to his office for his first day at work. And then he got a call from the car park attendant who said, you're going to have to... John McFarlane was his name, he was at ANZ Bank, and he said, oh, Mr. McFarlane, you're going to have to move your car because we don't allow red cars in the executive car park. And John McFarlane said, hang on, this is ridiculous. But instead of moving his car, he kept his car there for the 2 weeks until his daughter left, because he just wanted to send a signal. And what had happened was a previous CEO had an accident, a car accident, and with a red vehicle. And from that point in time, all red cars had been banned from the car park because the previous CEO was annoyed that he'd had this crash with a red car. So that rule had stayed in place, even though that CEO had long ago left the company, and it was just one of these rules that kept on going. But John McFarlane wanted a signal to people in the company that, you know, you're allowed to break the rules. And I'm not going to put up with ridiculous bureaucracy. So the red car story went around the organization like wildfire. And people got this message, you know, this is a symbol, there's going to be change, and I'm allowed to question the old rules. So exactly like you say, Ed, it's, symbols are very powerful during culture change.
I would think doing something as well, just to extend this a little bit, to say that it's okay to fail. To a certain point. without
Correct.
Thinking you're going to get fired.
Yeah.
Experiment.
Correct.
So is this how you change
absolutely.
Workplace? Yeah. So this, I'm sure, is much more scientific, but all this is about how to change a workplace culture, right? It's an attitudinal shift.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to your original question. How do you change culture? Well, you've got to, if you think about culture, it's comprised of mental maps, firstly. So people have a mental map of their world that they carry around in their heads, and that mental map is a bit like a GPS. So your GPS helps you to navigate in the world. It gives you a map of where you are and where you should be going to. But sometimes your GPS can be out of date. So you can be running a map of the world that is an old map that needs to be updated, and it can actually take you in the wrong direction. And this is going on constantly in our workplaces, where people have a mental map of their role that is outdated. It's a role that was there in the past. It's a role that's not aligned with how the leaders see their role or where the organization needs to go. So often during culture change, you need to update the mental maps that people hold about their role, and that can lead to faster change.
Well, this is really interesting. So I see in your bio that one of your work experiences has been case study at Harvard Business School, Could you tell us a little bit about that? That's quite an honor.
Yeah, so that was Professor John Cotter called me up and had heard about the work that we were doing. That was at ANZ Bank, or ANZ Bank, as you might say in the States. But ANZ Bank was being led by a CEO called John McFarland, and this was in the 2000s, and it was a seven-year culture change journey that when I joined the bank and when John joined the bank as well, it was the worst performing bank in the country. So it had very low customer satisfaction rates. It was being just bank bashing was a national sport. So people sort of, you know, from radio announcers to journalists to the public, the general public, they all were joining the fray of condemning the banks for lack of transparency on fees, hidden fees and charges, complex products, and probably most of all, closing down branches in rural Australia where people really needed their bank service. So the bank, you know, the staff in the bank had desperately low morale, and in fact, when we surveyed them at that stage, over half of the staff would prefer to be working somewhere else. They were very disengaged. So it was the lame duck of Australian banking, the ANZ Bank. And over a seven-year journey, that bank, under John McFarland's leadership, went from the worst performing bank in Australia to one of the highest performing banks in the world. So it became the number one bank on the Dow Jones Sustainability Index. It went to the highest customer satisfaction ratings of the big banks in the country. It had leading edge, world leading class employee engagement scores. And it was doing good in the community. So it was an amazing journey, seven-year journey of cultural transformation that I was involved in as a culture change advisor.
So I've enjoyed this conversation with you, and I've learned a lot. And I feel that we could probably continue this conversation into global talent development and strategy and design, succession planning. Let me ask you just a quick question, if I may, as we come to a close. As you're expanding, you're going to be probably into M&A, but also probably going to have a need to transfer people or relocate staff. You probably do that now Australia and New Zealand. So is that something that is blank check, just go, here's money, or send us your receipts and we'll pay for it? How do you handle the relocation stuff?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Well, we've had to get a mobility specialist on board to help us navigate this because, you know, my experience tells me that if you have the open check, and I have been in organizations where that is the case, that you get a very disaggregated approach. So it's almost like everybody makes up the rules according to what the individual demands are. And we certainly didn't want that here at Dulux Group. We wanted consistent policies and procedures that can apply globally. So we've got a team in place working on what is fair, what is reasonable, and what is globally consistent, so that it's not every person going to, like if we send somebody to Aberdeen or we send somebody to San Diego or we send somebody to China, that it's a make it up as you go along. It's every person for themselves. We don't want that. So we've got a team currently looking at what are the globally applicable rules and regulations in relation to our people moving to different countries and different territories. So that's a project we've got underway at the moment, Ed.
We've been talking with Siobhan McHale. You might tell she is a culture change specialist. She's EGM, Executive General Manager of Human Resources for Dulux Group Limited out of Melbourne, Australia. Thanks very much for being our guest today on Global Radio Talk Show. And we look forward to meeting you in person someday when we produce one of our Global HR Business Conferences Down Under.
Terrific. Great talking with you today. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you. This is Ed Cohen in San Diego, and that was Siobhan McHale in Melbourne. Signing off. Bye-bye.
Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful